you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 253 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. And today my guest is Leslie Tain. Leslie Tain is an attorney, the head of Tain Law, who focuses on consumer debt resolution and has a multi-location, multifaceted practice, primarily located in the Long Island, New York area, but also serving clients throughout the U.S. So she talks about her rise in the legal field, starting from a young attorney with, three kids at a very early part of her career, and managing to develop a law practice and raise a family and do all those things that that sound so inspirational and are, in fact, just that. So there's a lot to learn from somebody like Leslie, and I hope you enjoy doing so with this conversation with Leslie Tain. Leslie, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you, Ms. Tain. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I am a financial attorney. I am the founder and director of the Tain Law Group. We have multiple offices. My firm concentrates in the area of consumer and business debt resolution and alternatives to bankruptcy. I don't know that we have enough time to talk about from where I came from and where I am now, since that journey has been long. But with that said, I will tell you that I started off as in a different field. Mm-hmm. I was a public defender for a short period of time, and I worked in the jails, and I didn't find it so fulfilling. So I took a position as in-house counsel to a national debt company, and I didn't know where my career would take me, but it's one of those things that you open a door and an opportunity, and there went my career. Yeah. So I started there. And then after a couple of years of not seeing eye to eye in terms of compliance with those that be, I left and started my own practice. And I built my practice over the years as a single parent with three kids. And I built a very successful business and reputation. So I'm super proud of that.
Well, let's circle back a little bit. You know, when you talk about career development, you know, I think that's kind of almost the more typical approach. You know, nobody really knows what they want to be when they grow up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you just find something that takes off with you and then you take off with, and that becomes your career. And I think, you know, you could call it serendipity or karma or just the luck of the draw, or maybe it's fate. I don't know. But I think a lot of people fall into that situation, and lovely that you have still found that to be fulfilling after, you know, this period of time.
So I always wanted to be a lawyer. And when I applied to law school, they said, don't write us an application essay that says that you always wanted to be a lawyer. So I did from a young age. That was what I wanted to do. My father, who's an attorney, tried to talk me out of it. He actually said, it's not a great career for women. And he told me that shouldn't really be the way to go. And clearly, I didn't listen. And like most kids, they're not necessarily going to listen to their parents' advice, but that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I felt destined to do. As far as the type of law that I practice, interestingly enough, it's not the type of law that you can concentrate in or specialize in while you're in law school. You go to law school for generalization. And I worked mostly while I was in law school in the public service sector, thinking that I would serve the public. I worked at the DA, the Attorney General's office, and I thought that that's where my career was headed. And my first position, which was difficult to get, so those that are out there that are struggling to find work, I struggled very, very much to find my first position. It wasn't very well paying, but it was a foot in the door. And it was an interesting position, but it wasn't something that I felt was, I felt frustrated in the position that I couldn't make enough of a difference for those that were in the position that I was representing. So I also had a young child at the time. My daughter was about 9 months old, and I thought I wanted to be home a little bit more and have some more flexibility. So I took this position as in-house counsel to this debt company, and not knowing anything about the debt world. And that was quite an opportunity for me. And I learned a lot. I taught myself a lot. I learned a lot. I grew with the company. But I did always want to be a lawyer. So I have to sneak that in.
It's interesting that you went to a practice area that isn't focused on in law school. You're right. I think the closest you come to a class that might be relevant is commercial transactions.
Yep, UCC or debtor-creditor law.
Exactly. But that doesn't really prepare you for the ins and outs and the nuances to be found in, you know, consumer debt resolution. That
absolutely kind of, not. You know, and I have to tell you, I don't know that there's any class other than right. If I taught it that could teach you about what I've experienced in this arena.
I find it interesting and a little bit encouraging to hear you say that you were able to land a job as an in-house counsel in an area that you really didn't have any experience in, but that you could grow and assert yourself and become profound in.
Yes. So as you can tell, I am super ambitious. And I felt at the time, as I still do today, that I'm like a sponge and that if it's presented to me in front of me, I can figure it out. And there was a lot of times in the beginning of my career during that time, because I was still a very young lawyer.
Yeah.
And I'm sure young professionals often feel this way, because I know I certainly did, that you feel like you're floundering, that what am I doing? I don't know how to answer the question. I don't know what the right thing to say is. How do I create processes and procedures? But truthfully, I was and still am very, not only ambitious, but also creative. And I was able to create opportunities for myself to get the assistance that I needed to be successful. So it takes time, but certainly in the beginning, I was willing to take the position. It made sense for me. I wasn't happy where I was, and I never expected what it would turn into, yeah, for sure.
What really interests me, though, is that I suspect, and I think I'm guilty of this to some degree, or was guilty of this to some degree when I was applying for jobs coming out of law school, that, you know, you see positions for of counsel, or in-house counsel, rather, opportunities, and being a baby attorney, you think, I'm not qualified for that. Who's going to hire me as in-house counsel? I don't know the first thing about debt relief. But yeah, you're here to say that.
Don't judge yourself.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're here to say that may be true. You're not going to get hired at in-house counsel in a big multi-million-dollar, you know, international corporation. But
not as head or lead in-house counsel, but you might be hired. And when you, the worst that anybody could ever say to you is no. So yeah, you apply and they say, and even when I look at resumes that I come across my desk these days where people are really either unqualified or it's outside their league. Okay, so they tried. You never know what they're actually looking for. And perhaps what sealed the deal was the interview. So yeah, I didn't have a lot of experience, but I was willing to learn. And I had some experience in the legal field and I had a very good resume coming from law school. I did optimize my time while I was in school with a lot of different work environments. So I did have some work experience.
Yeah. And I think those forward-minded company employees who are looking for the right fit for their company sometimes know better. And know that, you know, I need this type of person more than this type of qualification.
Right. You can teach qualifications, and I'm saying this as an employer, yeah, now. You could teach qualifications. What you can't teach is what's inside and right, some of the characteristics of the individual. So even when I look to hire, and this is something we can talk about further along, but I look to hire those who have certain qualifications that are not on paper. So that's definitely part of the hiring process.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And then you did all of this while slinging around a 9-month-old.
Yes, I did. I had a 9-month-old, and then shortly thereafter, I had twins. So I had, while I was...
So you are truly a glutton for punishment.
Yeah. Yes, and I worked until I was 40 weeks pregnant with my twins. And I went in and I had them, I had a C-section with them, and I went back to work within 2 weeks of having a C-section. And also I had challenges once I gave, you know, during the birthing process, I did have some challenges, but I did go back to work very quickly. In fact, I was so worried I was actually going to lose my job. So at the time when I got pregnant with the twins, I went to my bosses who were males and I said, I'm so sorry. I promise I'm coming right back. That's how I phrased it. I know that may be shocking to those listening to this today, that that's not your thought process at all, that moms, dads are all at this point entitled to and are able to get, in many cases, are able to get time off. I took no time off. And I was working when I got home. They were bringing papers to me because I couldn't drive. But I went right back to work.
I think it's instructive for us to remember that, you know, while the current environment is not perfect for women and for people of color in the legal world, it's a darn sight better than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Yep. And this was only 20 years ago. So.
And that doesn't excuse any, you know, bad behavior. I'm not saying that, but it's important upon us to reflect that you felt you had to make sure that everybody knew that it was your intention to come back as quickly as possible.
Yep. And I wasn't going to miss a beat. And I really wanted my bosses to know that I was dedicated. It didn't matter. I mean, again, I worked until I was 40 weeks pregnant with twins. Mm. And for those out there who've had that experience, twins is considered a high-risk pregnancy. And I was still going to work, even when I had to be driven to work because I was just too big to sit behind the wheel. But yes, it was only 20 years ago. And that was one of many experiences that I had that are quite different than what things are today.
Sure. Sure. And now we've had plenty of folks who've developed practices on the show that frankly cater to that situation. You know, they're looking for employees who demonstrate that family commitment because it's consistent with their branding, so to speak, and just the way they look at people. And so you now see, you know, attorneys with their children in the office, daycare centers in the law offices, of course, when we had offices and people could go there. So it's just remarkable to think how far we've come, and by the same token, you know, how far we still have to go.
True. My commitment to my family was based on the need that I needed the money, that I needed to support my three little children. So that was my family commitment, that I needed to go back to work, and I didn't want to be in a position where my bosses didn't think I was dedicated to the commitment. I didn't want them to think. I mean, there was still the stigma back then that if you hired a young female who was recently married, that you were going to lose her to, you know, once she had a baby, that was it. And there was a judgment at that time that, you know, you may not get time out of that employee. So that was the thought that was in my head, that I didn't want them to think that. So,
I had, you know, a similar experience when I came out of law school, being an older, and by older, I mean the oldest one in my class. You know, when I applied to dozens and dozens and dozens of firms who said, politely said, thanks, but no thanks, you know, I recognized they didn't want a at that time, darn near 50-year-old associate, because they're looking like, how long am I going to have that person in my employee?
Right. And then you run into other issues from age discrimination.
Right.
Issues,
and so I didn't necessarily feel it was an age discrimination, although it clearly is.
But from their perspective, they didn't want you to make that kind of claim.
Right. For me, it felt more like it was a business decision on their part. You know, I want an associate that I'm going to have here 20 or 30 years, and can this person be that individual? So besides that, so you knew at an early age you wanted to be an attorney, and then you did this great stint as a consumer debt in-house counsel for a debt company. So did you also always know that at some point you wanted to start your own firm?
No, that was the furthest thing from my mind, to be honest with you. I never thought about that I would just go out.
Because usually people who are that ambitious and that focused in the very beginning usually have that in mind.
So I didn't. That wasn't necessarily a goal of mine. And when I look back, I don't know that I was super goal oriented. I had a lot going on when it came time to, from the, you know, I had three little kids and the challenges with three babies under the age of 2.5 and getting and going to work and childcare. And then, you know, what happened was when I was leaving that position, there were some challenges and it was presented to me, why don't you just start your own firm? And I was a little bit afraid to start my own firm alone. So I thought I needed a male partner in order to assist with the process because a lot of law and the debt world, the collection, the debt world, the debt buying world was really an old boys club. Yeah. And I felt that I was excluded from that, even though like I was always a great athlete and I got along great and I still do get along great with men and I can talk to them and all that. I connected, but I was still a female. And in an old boys club, I thought I needed a male partner. So I brought in, when I left that, I brought in a male partner for like, I'm going to say a month.
Okay.
And so we started a firm, a partnership. And after the first month, he had serious trust issues and work ethic issues. And the challenge there, we did not see eye to eye. So in terms of what needed to be done, I felt that if the toilets needed to be scrubbed, then that's what needed to be done. And there was an accountability piece. So I just said, you know what? I don't think this is going to work. Why don't I just buy you out of your investment? We're not too far along here. We're only about a month or so into this. And I did. And I went out and just did it on my own. And, you know, I proved to myself that I could do it on my own. But I really felt at the time that would I be taken seriously as a woman in this industry is a tough industry, the collection world and the debt world. And I just had to push through.
So tell me what life was like then. I mean, nowadays we have a few more options in terms of how I'm going to establish my practice and physically how I'm going to lay out the business. 10, 15 years ago, there were fewer options. So did you know you wanted to do a brick and mortar type situation? And if so, you know, how did that come about? And what were your challenges?
So there were a lot of discussions about how to set it up, the name, the corporate identity, putting that together, opening bank accounts, a location that made sense, office space where there was a cost, you know, and some projections as far as where the money would come from. So I didn't have any credit. You know, I was still under the age basically of 30 years old. Yeah. And so, or around 30 years old. So I didn't really have credit and think that I was going to go to a bank. So we took the money at the time I was married and we took the money from equity in the house and we used that as our initial investment into the business. And that was, I never needed to take another loan. I was able to become very self-sustaining, but it didn't mean that it wasn't a tremendous amount of work. So once my partner was finished and I was on my own, then it was, how am I going to bring in business and set things up? And I started to bring in business and go through a lead generation process and figure out to create cash flow. That was the number one goal. How can I create cash flow? Once I was able to create cash flow, I then hired somebody to come in and kind of assist me. So to answer the phones. And then it just grew from there. And there were certainly a lot of challenges there. I mean, it was definitely uncharted territory. I'm going to say that it was very similar to, and the vision that comes to mind is like on this, you're underwater and you're in like a kelp forest and there's sharks around and you can't see anything and there's water inside your goggles and you could barely breathe and you're just feeling around your way to find your way to the light. That is how I would describe the beginning of my business.
That's an apt metaphor. I like that.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. For many years, marketing companies have focused on funnels that run for a short time, often leaving dozens of leads behind that didn't make a decision yet. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. It's called a content loop, and it's changing the way attorneys think about their marketing. This system nurtures your leads in perpetuity with quality, evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing actually work. If you're interested in learning more, head over to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, To learn more about the Content Loop and how it can revolutionize your law firm's marketing, spotlight branding, more referrals, better clients, higher return on investment.
Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone. And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress. So you had all the mechanics in place, the name, the branding, the location of your office, size of your office. You figured all this out in terms of a budget of what you have to spend and an income, what you're going to need in order to afford those resources. But the $64,000 question, you know, as you alluded to, is where am I going to get those clients? How am I going to get those clients? How did you go about marketing your practice in the beginning?
So I didn't market the practice in the beginning. Certainly not as what would define marketing today. So the marketing and branding, the definitions of what that is today, did not exist 20 years ago the same way.
Right.
What I did do that was super smart was I got my URL for attorney-New York before the year 2000. And that seemed to propel me a little bit in terms of online marketing. I also started...
Was that a conscious decision or did you just accidentally stumble upon attorney-New York?
Yep, that was a conscious decision because at the time, back then, those URL, the names were important. The website names were important.
Yeah, were very important.
Right. Exactly. So attorney-New York was available and I scooped it up and I still have it today, but we use Tain Law. But with that, it was an opportunity. I didn't realize at the time how much of an opportunity it was, but the importance of the name of the web address was there. So I started to build a website, create some online presence, which again, back then in the year, around the year 2000, 2001, 2, and 3, this was cutting edge. I mean, this was
For sure.
I could tell you that there are still attorneys who first got their websites a few years ago. So with that, it was very unique. But the key was to try to find the clients. So how was I going to find the clients? Now, that didn't come from my own lead generation online through my website. I wasn't up to that yet. I was in the beginning, I was buying leads and purchasing opportunities. So there were lead generation companies that sold leads that were reasonably priced back then. And I would buy those leads and I would cold call those people from those leads and have conversations, close those deals, and move on. So I was kind of doing everything at the time. I was not getting referrals. One of the challenges I thought I had at the time was not only the female piece, but I look very young and I'm very mm-hmm. thankful for that.
Yeah.
But at 30 years old or 31 years old, I look like I just graduated from law school And I didn't think there was a lot of credibility. So I didn't spend a lot of time out and about in the referral and the networking world. I spent a lot of time really focusing on the processes and procedures and building that client base. It was only a few years later that I started to go out and venture out into the local community, the local business community, where I then started to meet people and build relationships that brought me a lot of referrals from the outside.
It's an interesting approach. And I think, you know, it, again, it speaks to the transition of, over time is how that has changed. But, you know, for our younger listeners that are pounded day in and day out by some company that wants to sell them leads, the plethora of companies that do that are there because in the beginning, that worked.
It did. It did. And it was cheap in the beginning.
It was cheap and it was spot on.
Yep. Very reliable.
The thousands upon thousands of imitators have now watered that down to the point where, in my humble opinion, your mileage might vary, that those kinds of opportunities are, you know, next to worthless. So it's interesting to see how...
I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. Yeah. That things have changed. Listen.
Sure.
Things
sure, they have.
And it's not that there aren't legitimate companies out there, but finding them and finding what works for you that's cost effective.
So that remember, are cost effective. Yeah.
When you are trying to convert and bring in new business, there's a cost to bring in that business. And you, as the business owner, need to understand what the cost is to bring in clients, patients, or otherwise. And if it's costing you $50 or $100 just for the call, and then you know, in certain cases, let's say personal injury, it might be worth it because if you get a $10 million case, then $100 or $200 or $300 to bring that lead in was worth it. When you are in a different type of business and your margins are smaller or your value is smaller on each individual client or
legal matter. Yeah.
Right. Then in those type of matters, it's not necessarily worth it. You as the business owner have to compute that and know where your break-even point is.
Well, the other thing that allowed you to do, which is fortuitous, is that it allowed you to concentrate on processes and procedures and making sure that the systems that you had to run your practice were in place when you were ready to scale up.
Yes, that, and it really gave me a lot of experience in talking to those potential clients so I could understand what their needs were and then begin to market to them based on what I understood their needs to be, how I spoke to them, and then the ability to train those that came in after me and under me to then convert potential leads. I was able to teach them and understand what my clients' needs were or the potential clients' needs are and really perfect that, what I would call script.
Yeah. So now you've got the practice off the ground. You're running. You're building your base. You've got cash flow. You're starting to network to further the acquisition of new clients, and things are starting to grow. At some point, you know, I know the history here. Now you needed to open additional offices and different additional locations. Talk to us a little bit about the thinking that went behind those decisions.
So the catalyst that propelled the business to that position was not necessarily my thought process, was a change in the law. So around 2006-ish, they changed the law in New York State and around the country because these debt settlement and debt consolidation companies were out there taking advantage of consumers and causing a lot of consumer pain or additional consumer pain. As a result, the legislators and the authorities took positions where they started to restrict that and they changed the law. And as a result of changing the law, I had to pivot where I was at and focus only on consumer debt resolution, where I, before that, there weren't such restrictions. There are now licensing requirements, not only in New York State, but in other states as well for this industry. So by being an attorney in the state of New York, I'm exempt from that licensing because my practice is solely focused in that area. So with that said, I had to pivot. So my thinking was a result of a change in the law. And I have to tell you, I love the change in the law. And I love when they come down and they start focusing on these industries because it is an opportunity, unfortunately, in this industry to take advantage of consumers, as many know, due to the poor reputation that the industry has. It's a very good service if it's done right. But unfortunately, there are a number of bad apples that have spoiled the industry. And with that, that works for me because I'm one of those that that try to pioneer the best practices. But that's where my thinking came from. My thinking came from, uh-oh, I now have to pivot for a change. And other business people find this when things change as well, that there's a new change in the law and now you're going to have to pivot, either rebrand. And we had to rebrand at that time. So we ended up rebranding the company and focusing solely on what was the law offices of Leslie H. Tain PC to just a focused firm on consumer and business debt resolution. So then at that point, as a result of those changes, a lot of companies were closing down. And I was contacted by some attorneys that had worked for these other companies saying, hey, we have tons of clients in limbo now. We feel badly. Or the companies are being closed down. You know, would you be able to take over these files? And again, that opportunity created a need for me to rethink this, the way I was approaching my business. And then I needed bigger office space and more staff and a big change at that point.
Yeah. So now you're spread out across multiple locations, right?
Yes. Yes, we are.
And still dealing with the pandemic as well. So that adds another layer of complexity. Tell us a little bit about the pressures of how to organize your staff in terms of a multi-office location, you know, firm, and how you create some independence and yet some consistency across those geographically dispersed locations.
So those processes and procedures have to be solid. They have to be, the foundation has to be there, and the processes and procedures, accountability and responsibility have to be in place so everybody understands what their role is. Over time, I was able to create those processes and procedures to the point where we explored the franchising of the business as well. So in order to have multiple locations and people working in different places or people working remotely, there have to be systems in place where there's an ability to be accountable, and you have to have the right staff who will be accountable. But the processes and procedures really are the key to the management of that.
Okay, we'll get to staffing in a second here. Tell me how your policies, processes, and procedures manifest themselves. Is it a gigantic book of all of the above, or do you have an in-house Wikipedia or some kind of online repository?
Thankfully, it's not online, so it's not accessible. But so it's under lock and key. We had a process and procedure manual built a number of years ago. I brought somebody in, an outsourcing agency that does that and specializes in that. They came in and sat with all of my staff members and went over every single process and procedure. So everything we did was memorialized from start to finish. So that was also as kind of as a result of, the lessons are always learned. So yeah. I had an employee that went out on maternity leave and then decided that they didn't want to come back, but it was a very valuable, important position. And the challenge at that time was, how do we replace this person and with a seamless transition? And what ended up happening was, well, we need to have something in writing. So I said, all right. So I met a woman whose company did that, and we hired her and brought her in to do that. So that was really the reason behind it. But it was written, and it is written, and it gets updated on a regular basis. But the processes and procedures are in stone in terms of they are there. We know what's happening. So if somebody else was to come in to take a position blindly, they could open up this book and they could follow it procedure step by step and not miss a beat.
And one of the things I hear you saying is that it's also, while it's cast in stone, it's also a living document that's paid attention to throughout the year. You just can't write the book, put it on the shelf and say, poof, I've got this piece done.
No, it'll be outdated super quickly. So when I mean set in stone, I just meant that it was written, but
adherence to it is set in stone.
Yeah. That is a living, breathing document. Yeah. It can't be something that you put there and say, okay, great. We now have our process and procedures. I could shelve this. And then if I need it in a year or two, I'll pull it out. No, that has to be updated on a regular basis. I'm going to say on a monthly basis, somebody in the office should be responsible for reviewing those processes and procedures and also ensuring that the staff are following those processes and procedures. Yeah. Things do change and we get more efficient as time goes on. So some of them become antiquated and are eliminated. with new technology and new processes.
Sure, for sure. Now, you mentioned your staff and how important staff is to this whole concept of building a robust multi-location practice. Tell us a little bit, do you have any kind of specific process that you go through when evaluating an individual for a position with your company?
So that is a very challenging question. So while we write out the obvious, the job description, what we're looking for, we often look at the search, you know, the different type of qualifications that we're looking for, the type of individual that would make a good fit for our culture and our clients. Those are important pieces of the puzzle. I can tell you how challenging it has been over the years to find the right people and to get people to say yes. It could be location issues. It could be the time of year. It could be even in the pandemic, and we've been looking to hire multiple positions in the last several months. That I could tell you that in one position, three people who went through the entire process turned it down. So it has not been an easy process to hire under any circumstance. And I think that's certainly one of my biggest challenges. And I would say it's probably always going to be one of the biggest challenges is the staffing piece, even though we write it all out and we know what we're looking for.
Do you do any kind of personality testing associated with your hiring process?
We do, like a DISC assessment.
Right.
So yeah, so I'm very familiar with the DISC assessment. One of the important pieces of that puzzle is knowing who you are and what your style of communication is. So I am in that DISC assessment clearly a high D. So I like things super to the point, and I have to be aware of that not only during my interviewing but also in the management of my staff. So I also look. And I can tell without having to necessarily go through the whole testing,
right,
sort of what that person is just by the way the questions go and the responses go. But we do use that, and we have another testing program that we use. And I recently used it on a candidate. And as a result of the results, I felt that that wouldn't be a good fit for us. So it is a very useful tool, I would say, especially if you're on the fence and you're not sure that that person is a good fit for your company.
I have to admit my own personal bias in terms of these personality and tools. I personally have yet to get the value out of them that others have, but I recognize that a great many people just couldn't run their business without it. They're completely part of the process that they use for evaluating staff members, and they would have it no other way. So
I completely agree. I think it's a very useful tool.
So I recognize that I'm kind of the outlier there.
No, I think it's a very I think it's a very useful tool, and I think that it's very helpful. Those that use it regularly, it's not a requirement to have a successful business to use it, but it is helpful to understand your staff and how everybody interacts and what you're going to get out of that person.
So we've talked about a lot of the great things that have happened and some things that have developed over the course of time that worked out to your benefit. I'm sure along the way, some things didn't work. Some things you wish you would have done differently, or had you known then what you know now. Does anything specific come to your mind of something that you would think that people starting out with a firm might want to try and avoid or minimize these days?
So the first thing that came to my mind was fire faster.
Yeah.
So when I look back at mistakes, and I do not use the word mistake. They are learning experiences. So one of the things that I have learned, although it's a challenging and sometimes costly lesson to learn, is that fire faster. So where there's smoke, there's fire. But as you start to become dependent and work on not being dependent completely on employees, even though you do depend on them. So there's a very fine line there. So I would say if you're starting out your own firm and you're starting a business, when you start to hire, be prepared that that person has to be meeting your expectations and have a process and procedure for evaluation of your employees and have open discussions with them. And if you feel that that person is not working out well, don't wait 6 months or a year for it to work out because it's not going to. So that's my first. That would be the first thing that came to my mind as far as lessons.
Well, that's great. You know, there is a book, I should have that author's name memorized by now, says hire slow, fire fast.
Yep. Yes.
So
that's not always practical. I agree with it. It's just not always practical.
Of course not.
But especially when it's challenging to hire and fill certain positions and it's expensive to move staff around like that.
Well, listen, Leslie, I've learned a lot here about your practice of law and how that has benefited you. And it's great to hear this, you know, story of your success that built upon hard work. Tell our audience, what's the best way to reach out to you to follow up regarding anything you've said, or if they have a question about how you did something or sure. your experiences that you've had?
Well, I'm always open to communication. You can certainly find me on LinkedIn if you have questions. If you're running or starting a business and you have questions, thoughts, or concerns about branding or marketing your business or anything that I can contribute to, I'm happy to do so. You can certainly find me on LinkedIn, but you can find me on Twitter as well at Leslie H. Tain ESQ and Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Tain Law Group. And certainly feel free at any time to reach out to me. I'm happy to have discussions. I think one of the most valuable things that you could do as a business person is find mentors and colleagues to bounce ideas and thoughts off of, especially when you're solo as I have been. Yeah. The learning curve is a lot lower and it's more challenging. So don't be afraid to reach out to your colleagues and say, hey, how have you handled this? What are your thoughts on something like this? And I'm certainly a resource for those of you out there to reach out to.
That's wonderful. And I appreciate that, Leslie. So you have a great day. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur. And we look forward to hearing from you again sometime in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.